And welcome back to another episode of L&D Disrupt. This week's returning guest is Ross Stevenson, the founder and chief learning strategist at Steal These Thoughts. Now, if you follow Ross, you would have seen him recently share a template about what to do before you buy learning tech, including auditing whether your existing tech can really solve your problems. So I thought it would be great to have Ross back on the show to talk us through some of the key points of this template, which you can find linked in the description. Expect to learn why we need to define problems before we start searching for tech, advice on using what you've already got, tips for finding tech that fits and solves problems, and how we can test drive tech effectively before we commit. If you're looking for more advice on auditing your current tech and how to search for future tech to solve your problems, you can still sign up for HowNow's What the Fluff Bootcamp that has a dedicated module and tons of other great frameworks that will help. Just head to gethownow.com/WTF-bootcamp or use the link in the description to sign up and get started today. Thanks a lot, and here's my conversation with Ross Stevenson. The reason I wanted to speak with you, Ross, is you shared this great template recently about questions to ask before you potentially buy tech. And part of that is about auditing the tech you already have. And we're going to cover all that today. But in case anyone missed that LinkedIn post with the link to the template and the video, I'm going to drop it in the chat now. And it'll be in the description for everyone listening to the recording. But before we get into all that, one question is, why are people so inherently drawn to new tech? Because you mentioned in another post that I will share that the average organization has 88 different pieces of digital tech for employees, which I thought personally was mind-blowing. So how come we're ending up in this process and this situation where people are so enamored by new tech, but not necessarily defining the problems it should solve?
Yeah, because I think it's just sexy and fun, right? When you see something shiny and it's advertised in your face and it's like, this is going to solve your problems, you're like, oh my God, like this is amazing. This is going to solve all my problems. So, you know, I must do that. And what generally happens is, this happens in any industry, but we have market expectations. So I think we all experience this in the terms of, you know, we might read stuff on LinkedIn, we see case studies, and we feel like we're kind of missing out. And the market is fundamentally placing these expectations on us to say that if we don't have X tool, that, you know, we're not doing the right stuff. Employees aren't getting the right. I mean, the classic case of this right now, we all know this, is generative AI, which is just like this on steroids, to be honest, where there's so many tools. 99% of them are crap, in my opinion, to be honest. But, you know, we'll see how that goes over the next few years. But you're seeing the same thing where it's like, if your company isn't using this tool right now, then all of your employees are going to fail and this is going to fail. So, and that's hard, right? Because it's marketing psychology that's used on us to say, if you don't do all this, you're not going to have that. And in reference to the talk, I think what was really interesting about that talk is that, so those figures that came from this a couple of years ago now, a bit of research that I did for a talk at Learning Technologies in London, that 88 was actually the lowest figure. So that was the lower end. I mean, as the company sizes got bigger, you were getting up to something around 200 different applications for employees to choose from. And if my memory serves me correctly, there were so many duplicates there. So what you can already kind of foresee is the amount of money and time and people resource that is spent on that duplication. So the answer to the question really is, I think it's that A, we haven't really done investigation as to what do we have. B, it is the maximization of what you already have. And I see that because a lot of the tools that we probably all consider as day-to-day tools, I would guarantee you're probably only using them to about 10% of their capabilities. And I see this all the time. So when I go and do work with companies, what I always find the classic example is if we take Slack as a, you know, people look at it, it's just an instant messaging tool, whereas actually you can do a lot more with it from automations, building out workflows, integrations. It can handle a lot of stuff from onboarding, management development, loads of things it can do, but people only know it as an instant messaging tool. So it's situations like that where I think because we don't see that and it's not so obvious that we discount what we have and then we go buy the shiny new tool. And of course, the third element of what I just discussed is that because it's fundamentally shoved in your face all the time on social media and in emails that you get or what you see when you go to events like Learning Tech, which obviously have a good place, but you know, you're overwhelmed with 100 people saying, you know, get this or die type situation. So it's difficult. It is difficult as a buyer, and I get that because, you know, I've been a head of L&D. I've been a buyer of these tools. I've sat in countless sales meetings, and I know, you know, I know the score of how it goes, where everyone wants to tell me they've got this and 500 features, which I don't really care about. And I just need to kind of focus on one thing. So yeah, that would be my answer to that.
Yeah, I completely agree. We're definitely going to get into this idea of what are the unused features of tech you already have shortly. But I really agree with that point around the social proof, or everyone shouting about the tech they're using. I had a realization recently with Glassdoor that there are no 3-star reviews on Glassdoor. The company's either a 1-star or it's a 5-star. And I find the same thing with tech. Everyone who's like a 3 with tech is like, use it for some things. They're not shouting about it. But there's some people who are evangelists who skew it in a certain way because they're always shouting about how good it is. And there's some people that had such a bad experience. They're the 1-star people. So I feel like not necessarily getting swept up in that narrative, and you kind of alluded to that, is such a good reframing before you get sucked in.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that reviews are good. I think referrals and recommendations are better. So something I've always done in my own network is, you know, speak to the people who I know quite well at my level of different organizations, and really get to the source of people who are doing the same thing as me, and say, well, what are you using? How is it working? What would you recommend? Because, you know, as you can say, it's like the Amazon conundrum as well, is the same thing. Either there's the 1-star or there's the 5-star. There's no one in the middle that just went, yeah, it's actually quite decent. It's helping us get to where we are, and it'll help us scale later on. That's not controversial enough for those algorithms to work. So I mean, a lot of it is in, it's in the middle of actually speaking to practitioners. And I'm sure we'll get into this, but a lot of my own decision-making around buying has been because people that I trust and have known for many years in different organizations have said, you know, this is something we're using. It might be something you want to explore yourself. So yeah, I definitely say call on those sources of data, but make sure you're using that data to get an overall view of, is this going to be effective for me? Because just because something works really well for one organization and one culture and one infrastructure doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be right for your organization.
Awesome. Referrals better than reviews. I 100% agree. So that's great. I guess before we get into any of that, the first start of the starting point of the template you shared is getting that clarity on the problems you're actually going to solve. And you shared this kind of great framework around that. So tell us a bit about how we do actually discover the real problem to solve before we go looking for tech, existing or new.
Yeah, so I think the main thing is, and I'll try to keep this as simple as possible, is before you even think about technology, you need to frame your problems. You need to frame, you know, what are we trying to solve and why are we trying to solve that? Really, before we talk about any tool, and I think you can apply this to any technology. This is not just learning technology. You could do this for apps on your phone. You can do this for AI stuff that's going on right now. It's really simple and saying, okay, so make this clear. What are the things that I need to solve, either in the immediate or in the long term? And then being really specific on what are the components you're looking for in a tool to help you solve those problems? Because it may not be that whatever solution you decide to go for can solve every single components of that big problem that you've got. So you can break that down and say, you know, what are the key things here that I can see that a technology solution can enhance my work? And like the key word there is enhance. It's not to say, how can it be replace me completely and I can go off and, you know, not do any of this. There's always going to be a section of needing a human to do stuff. But we can look at the columns of how can it enhance. And then, of course, you can also start to ask about what can I delegate to it? So there's all the background stuff that you can work on there as well. And then with that, you really want to also think about with your problem, then, you know, who are you serving with this problem? So who is that end audience? And, you know, sometimes that may be the immediate L&D team. That may be something you're using in-house across your team there. It may be something that you're giving to a portion of the organization or all of the organization. But just like when any kind of company is selling a product, you need to look at, as you're building a product and your internal people, what we call your ideal customer. So who is your ideal customer in the organization? And then looking at that to say, are these decisions I'm making now going to serve the ideal customer profile in my organization? Is it going to hit all the notes that they want? So that's incredibly important, because if we're not focused on that. And some people might call that, from a design perspective, user-centered design. So it's very similar to that, but we're thinking more of that from a, shall we say, kind of product enablement perspective, to look at, is it going to serve those people specifically? There's another component in there, but my mind is leaving me right now. So if you can remind me, Gary, on my actual template, then I can speak to it.
What are you solving? Who are you serving? And what is the best tool for that job? So just bridging the gap between the two, I suppose.
Yeah, I pretty much connected those in there. So, but the main thing is always problem definition first, because most people do it backwards. So they go, I'm going to buy a tool, and then they get a tool, and then they go, what do I do with this tool now? Like, how do I use this tool? What problem is it actually solving? And what I find is, not just in the L&D space, but in general, is that a lot of tools hit the graveyard purely because they were just bought because someone said, oh, we need a tool to do X. And then they never found a use case for it. And it just sits around for 2 years because a 2-year contract's been signed. So I mean, if you can be really clear on those components of, you know, the problem that you are solving, who you're serving, you know, who is your ideal customer, and then looking at how is that tool going to actually support that. I mean, that simple framework, you can pretty quickly figure out, is this going to be the one for me or not? Definitely, if we look at kind of the pre-investigation phase, which is basically you going out and Googling or using ChatGPT to say, I need a tool to do X. Can you give me a list of suppliers in my area for that? You can do a pre-qualification just on those 3 points.
I completely relate to that. I've been going through this problem of bouncing around between tools to subtitle and clip videos. And because I didn't really have a firm criteria before that, I ended up with one tool I thought would work. And then I was like, actually, I need to add multiple logos to the video. And actually, I need to add a custom font. And then for it didn't actually work. So I had to wait. That's 1 month paid for that I couldn't use. I used something else, but actually it doesn't let me add the custom font, but it does the other thing. So I've finally settled on maybe something that works. But like you say, I went and dove into something before really framing and defining the core things it had to solve for me. And so I can personally relate to that. And I'd love to know if anyone else has had a similar experience in the chat. One thing you mentioned as well is about enhancing. And I actually really like this idea because often tech is about removing friction for the things that take too long, the things that are too manual, the things that actually stop you from doing a good job. And by knowing where friction exists, you can say the tech can reduce that friction, which allows us to get to the problem sooner. So I also think, do you think that is a useful mindset to just try and think about where the points of highest friction are at the moment as well?
Yeah, most definitely, because there's going to be, and we all experience this in the L&D world, there is a high amount of what I'd call kind of human admin. And I think a lot of the reasons why we make tech decisions is to say, how can I take all this crap that I really hate doing and get technology to do that for me? So there's definitely looking at what are those, what you call high friction, what are those kind of blockers, or what are those high priority blockers? And then saying, if I can remove that, what is that going to free me up to do? And I think, again, being really clear is, if it does free you up, what are you going to do with that time to free you up with to enhance the rest of the work that you're doing? So yeah, definitely, you can have that mindset of looking for that. And then the secondary layer is definitely enhancing. And what I mean by enhancing, it could be simple things where if you are having to collect data in your organization on learning impact, you know, you're not going to get a tool that does that for you end to end, but you are going to get tools that definitely help you in part of that journey. So it's really clear to look at what components can enhance what you're already doing. So basically, how is it going to make you work smarter, work faster, but also do that to a high quality level? And I think that's what, if we again go back to examples of AI at the moment, is that that's what some of that conversation is missing. We talk about speed and working smarter, but we're not always talking about the quality of work. So there's that element of, you know, if my line manager or my senior leader says, I need to understand what has been our important performance improvement in this area of the organization for the last 6 months, do you have a tool on hand that's going to save you maybe 30 to 40% of your time to get that data, to interrogate that data, and then you as a human present that data? So I think that's always a good thing to look at. It's not just purely about what can I wipe off my desk. It's also, you can look at this as more, let's say, long-term thinking, as in over the next couple of years, what can this continue to help me enhance? And, you know, the context matters here, because some of you might be in big enterprises, some of you might be in scale-ups, some of you might be in startups. You could be a team of one, you could be a team of 15 or 20, I don't know. So it really depends on your context in saying, can I use you know, tech to help me out with more of this stuff, depending upon the size of my team. And I'll give you an example where when I first started working at ScaleUps, I was always a team of one. So a lot of my assessment was, I'm not going to have any human resource, so I'm going to have to rely on digital assistants to actually help me do a lot of work. So my use case in that was, actually, I do need a tool where I am going to have to rely on it a lot more for some of the delegation, some of the automation. But an enterprise level is an example. You might be looking at something, well, I've already got a team of 20. So actually what I need it to do is these three core use cases, and then anything else is kind of a bonus. So context 100% matters in it.
I completely agree. We're going to move on to a bit more about the tech in a second. But on that point, you mentioned around looking for an end-to-end thing. And it comes back to what you said about understanding the audience as well, because I feel across every industry, when people are looking for tech, they're looking for the silver bullet that caters to every person. Mm. And that is also how you can end up buying something that doesn't serve you. So something we went through recently was, could we get a tool that incentivizes everyone in the company to share things on social media? And it would cost quite a lot to get a tool like that in. There's lots of things that gamify it. But actually, what if a percentage of our audience just, or internal customers just don't care, and they just wouldn't post either way? So, yeah, you know, investing in a tool that you think is going to do it, it's not the right audience. But saying maybe you have five people who would do it, just sit down and dedicate some time with those five people, and they're the right audience. So I think like not actually sitting down and working out the person also leads you into that blind alley of getting sucked into looking for the one size fits all that you're not going to find.
100%. Yeah. And I think, yeah, in the space that we're in, the learning tech industry itself is worth about $400 billion at the moment. So there's a lot of stuff that goes around. And even outside of what we kind of call learning technology, really any technology can be a learning technology based on its intent and how you're using it across an organization. So the point of the ideal customer and the great example you gave there is really good, because if you in a silo go and buy something and you've not spoken to the people who are going to use it, and actually they're using something which has a better user experience or a better user interface, you're going to find yourself in the same position again. So this is definitely not, when we talk about this, it's not keeping this internal in your team. It's engaging with the rest of your organization. And I'm, you know, we'll talk about this from piloting tools to basically say, we're looking at this thing, here's a license, go and use it for 2 weeks, let us know what you think. Instead of saying, what I usually see 99% of the time is, we bought this tool, here's a new tool, take this tool for the next 2 years and we'll do one training session at the end of the month and then you go figure it out from there. It's just, it doesn't work that way. And unfortunately, it hits the graveyard quite quickly.
Yeah, that, like, nobody is using the tool they never needed or wanted that we never asked them if they needed it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I hate to pick on it, but I think LinkedIn Learning is probably the worst one for that in most organizations that I see. I can't, you know, I mean, the amount of organizations that I've joined or consulted with or whatever, and someone's come across and gone, yeah, we got this email 7 months ago about getting LinkedIn Learning, but, you know, my team's never logged into it. I'm like, well, you know, that's just the norm pretty much for that. But that's a prime example, because I think that's an easy mistake to make, as in people just believe because people know the brand name, it just has an immediate credibility, and it has like, oh, it will be easy to use. Oh, it will be a great user experience, which it could be for some people. I don't know. Yeah. But for the large majority, if you launch anything in that way, it could be the best tool in the world. Honestly, you could have the most amazing tool in the world, but if you follow that plan of launching, it's never going to succeed.
100%. So we know context, we know the problems we want to solve. Before we rush into buying new tech, if we maybe have something like 80 upwards tools in the company, there's a chance that something in our existing tech can help us solve this problem. So what is your advice for assessing if something you've already got can solve the problem that you've just spent time defining?
Yeah, so this is going to depend. So there's two ways to do this. There's what I call kind of the local level, which is your team level. So you can basically look at, within your team of your solo N&D pro, what are, let's say, the 5 to 10 most common tools that you're using at the moment in time for this objective that you're trying to solve? And then it's spending a bit of time on those tools to look at, well, what else can they do? And it may be nothing. They may not do anything else, but at least asking the question and spending maybe an hour or two on a Friday afternoon just finding out what else can these tools do that I've already got. That can save you a lot of time and a lot of money. And that really works well if you're in a scale up or a startup and you don't have a infrastructure department. You don't have a big tech department. So that's probably going to be the best that you can do. Some scale-ups will have, you know, some tech teams. You might have an IT support team who is in charge of software acquisition. So I would definitely recommend, and I did this in many scale-ups I worked in, is reaching out to that team, just saying, look, we're looking through software procurement processes right now. Love to understand, what do we currently have on the books that fit this kind of tool category? And then you might be surprised when you get that list back. I definitely have been surprised, for sure. And then outside of that, what you can do, if you see something that looks interesting, you can then find, usually those lists come with a purchase owner or a tool owner. So you can go and find, you know, who bought that tool in the organization, if they're still there, have that conversation with them. So from a local level, you can do that. From a company-wide level, so if you're a mid-sized business or an enterprise organization, the immediate route is to go to your technology infrastructure team. They might be called infrastructure, they might be called InfoSec, they might be called technology acquisition. One of those names usually crops up in enterprises. And you can go and speak to them, and you can basically give them a bill of, again, very similar. These are the things that we're looking at doing as a team right now. We're looking at making some buying decisions. But before we do that, we just want to understand what's currently available in the organization. And when I used to work for a huge enterprise organization, we had like 350,000 people to work for the company. I had to do this religiously because we had so many tools, probably thousands of tools, where I would go to the infrastructure team and basically put together this brief every time of, we're looking for these things. It comes under this category. It'd be really great to understand, what have we already purchased as an organization? And unfortunately, a company that size, they can make hundreds of tools. So I did have to spend a bit more time to actually look at, you know, what might fit the bill for what I've got there. And then go and investigate those tools in the company. Now, who has licenses? Who is using it? How are they using it? It's a little bit of, you know, research and investigation on your part. But, you know, if you can find something that people have already adopted, they like the UI, they like the UX, it's got the capacity for you to scale that, then that's a really good win for you. And much like even in your local level, you might be using tools now that you use for a very specific use case, which is great, or a specific set of tasks that helps you. But then it may be also able to help you with another 10 tasks that you don't need help with, but other people in the organization do. And then you can say, okay, so how can we then tap into that? And then how can we scale that there too? So I think, you know, in enterprise, go to infrastructure team, go to your tech teams. In a scale up, startup, you know, go and talk to your tech teams there. Look at the current ecosystem of tools that you are using. And, you know, I'm sure many of you who do have learning tech right now, you've got account managers with your organizations. Go and speak to those account managers. I'm sure they're more than happy to help you. There's some great account managers with loads of organizations. If you just say to them, look, I'm looking to understand, can we leverage this tool to do a bunch of this stuff? They'd be more than happy to walk through that.
You've read my mind there, Ross, because I was about to say that I've used SEMrush for about 5 years before I actually reached out to my account manager and said, can you spend an hour with me going through all of these features? And I must have found 5 or 6 things I didn't know it could do that would save me a bunch of time. Mm. And it genuinely was about 5 years before I got to that point. So that is such a useful piece of advice to just go and speak to those people. I think visibility 100%. Is the key, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely the key there, I think. And you have to think as well, there's so many features of these products that come out over the years, even at months. Some companies are really good at terms of pace that you're never going to keep up with it all. So although it's kind of like, it's basically knowledge bias in many ways. It's like, because you've got a snapshot of what you remember buying the tool for at a specific point, that's kind of where your knowledge has stopped, because you've only continued to use it for that. And, you know, companies will always send out, we see it all the time, personal apps that we've got, they send out product developments, but I'm not sure a lot of people, I mean, actually read them to say, oh, we've just released our next product log, and this is the 10 things that we've done. So you don't know unless you ask. And as you say, you know, SEMrush was your example, Slack was definitely my example. You know, many companies have Slack. I didn't even know we had an account manager at one point when I was in my last organization, and I spoke to them. I had no idea. I was like, there's like 3 or 4 things I thought, oh, that's actually really helpful from a collaborative learning standpoint that I could use in my organization. And in that example, find if it saved me from going off and buying something else. So you never know.
The idea of the knowledge bias is fascinating to me. I think because you're right. Once you've brought it in because you think it's just to solve one particular problem, you kind of lose that curiosity. And like you say, tools release new things all the time, but the average email open rate is about 20%. And if there's 10 things in each email, think about the percentage chances of you spotting everything you wanted to know about it that's new.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No one's really, I mean, they would love to. I love product managers and love product teams, but unfortunately, people, even internally, they're not opening the product log to go, oh my God, you know, you change this thing here and I see that. So yeah, just ask. If you don't ask, you don't know. And that could be the difference between saving you $100,000 and, you know, using what you've got.
Yeah. I was just thinking there, no one is going like, wake up, the new ClickUp feature just dropped. We need to get on there right now. Cool. Perfect. I think that kind of covers some of the advice I wanted to give people around looking at their existing tech. If their existing tech doesn't solve a problem, or once we've done that audit and we can't find a tool that can solve it, what is your advice for then going out into the wider world and finding that new tool that we should consider?
Yeah, definitely. So that link that Gary's given you as well, the template, will definitely help guide you with that. I mean, it's super simple. It's just something I use all the time with my team at many different tech organizations that you can work through. But the bulk of breaking it down is you kind of have this pre-analysis phase. So we've covered that in some ways of defining what your problem is. So what is the thing that you're trying to solve? And then you can make kind of like then, if you call it a micro list under that, of what are your non-negotiables. So your non-negotiables are fundamentally, what are those things that you can't basically live without? It has to have. It's at the top of the list. So you can definitely cross out a lot of people based on those non-negotiables. And your first kind of protocol is to investigate what's available. So you could do this pretty easily. Like I say, we've spoken about, and we'll speak more about referrals, recommendations, using Google searches, et cetera, what's out there, who's talking. And based upon your context, what I would suggest you do is get to a shortlist of about 5 suppliers. I mean, don't go crazy because there's hundreds of people out there, but get to about 5 suppliers and then take time to look at their website. So a lot of, you know, this is for anything really, not just L&D, but a lot of good products will have websites where there's case studies. They talk about use cases. They have, you know, blogs where they're talking about how people are using the tool. You can see tool features. Maybe some of them will do, you know, live tutorials that you can watch. Do that research for about, you know, not huge, like 30 minutes to an hour for each of those vendors. And then use that template that is in my post there to basically walk through and answer all the questions that are on there. Because then once you get to the end of that and you've got your 5 suppliers, you've answered all those questions, you've kind of assigned a rating, you find out about the cost, your kind of first part is then to look at that with either yourself, if you're one person L&D team, or other people in your HR team, or look at that with your senior leaders and say, look, this is what we've identified so far. And then at that point, it's just having a bit of a conversation and you give them some recommendations. So it's more you coming in with data to say, these are 5 that we've looked at. I really like X, Y, and Z. And then saying, I think we should do this, and then have that conversation. And then post that is then basically to start to engage those companies. So you can start to go out to maybe 3 of those companies and go, okay, really interested in seeing, you know, what you can do. Love to learn more about that. Can we set up a call? You know, most of these will go through kind of a pre-sale stage where they want to learn more about you, which is very good because from a contextual standpoint, it helps them as well have that conversation around what are the problems you're trying to solve. So when I say have that problem already, that really helps a vendor to then go, oh, okay, I see you're trying to solve X, Y, Z. So I can then actually talk to you about the features that we have to do that instead of just saying, I need an LMS or an NXP because someone in my organization told me that we need one. That's not, it's not really helpful for you. It's not really helpful for a vendor on that part there. So you do that. And then once you've kind of gone through the pre-analysis phase, you've gone through kind of the next analysis phase, you get to a point where you've spoken to 3 people and then you can start to think about, okay, so I've seen more about the tool. You should definitely get a demo. Like spend time getting a demo, like a 45-minute demo with that organization and walking through what does it do, look at the ins and outs, understanding that from a top layer, and then take away that data. And again, go back to having a conversation with your team or the people that are involved or need to be involved in that conversation. And then again, giving your recommendation and saying, you know, what do you like from there? And what I would say at this point is you've got kind of 2 routes. Either you can say, you know, we can try to get maybe like a short pilot with 3 of them or maybe pilot's the wrong word, maybe a short test. So every company's different. I don't know every company's processes, but you could ask the vendor to say, look, we'd love to test a demo environment for a week or two, just so our senior leaders and our key people can take a look at the environment. They can play around with it. They can see how it works, et cetera, et cetera. That is just helping you validate what you're doing. And it's also validating that user experience with your ideal customer, because it's great you've seen it as an L&D person, but actually you want to get a selection of maybe about 20 to 30 people who can just dive in and they could just spend some time on it and they can just give you some feedback, which gives you a kind of diverse set of thoughts on how this could land in the organization. So you could definitely do that as a first port call for a demo. Based on that demo and the feedback you get, you might get down to two or one vendors, okay? And at that point, what you want to do, you're kind of in what I call the serious conversation stage, and you're talking about kind of costs and implementation. That I think the first thing to look at is, can you do a pilot agreement? And a pilot agreement usually is, from my experience, has been some kind of reduced cost, and you get a set of licenses for your organization or a portion of your organization, let's say for 8 weeks. And over those 2 months, and I've done this with basically all my suppliers, you can work with that supplier to look at how can we, A, understand, is this going to validate what we think our people need in the wider audience? And then how can we look at, you know, making this work? How can we actually see real-time data on, is this helping out our organization? Is it enhancing what we're doing, or is it hindering? And this is the best way to do it, because until you actually use these tools and you're using them day in, day out, and other people are using them, you don't really know. A demo is one thing. A live environment is another. So you need to be able to spend time to say, is this helping me do work faster and at high quality, or is it actually slowing me down? And then you can get really clear on that, because you don't want to be in a position where you say, yes, it's worth buying a two-year license, and then you figure out 6 weeks later, actually, the thing that you thought was going to help you work faster and smarter is not doing it. It's taking too much time. It's not working. So, you know, if you can, definitely get that demo. Make sure that demo has enough licenses to go to the key people in your organization that have the time. Like, I stress having the time, because you'll want to give it to leaders and stuff, you know, of all the will in the world. They might be sponsoring, but they're not going to go into it and have the time to actually do that. If you can get it in front of the people who are going to be using it from a main user perspective and get their feedback, that is going to be critical. And then once you've done that, I think the main thing then to do, of course, is you work with the vendors, you talk to them about, you know, is this something based on the data that you've got that you can see working? Yes, no. Of course, the obvious is if it's yes, you can continue to purchase. If it's no, then you don't. And you might have to repeat that cycle again. It happens sometimes. You might get a couple of tools. You might think, oh, they're really good. But then when you get them into a live environment, it doesn't quite work. And I'll give you an example of this at one organization where I was bringing on a OKR tool for objective and key results in a tech company. I went through a couple of cycles of this, because we were working with loads of companies. Some of them just specifically focused on OKRs. Some of them did loads of stuff that we didn't want, but we just wanted the OKRs on that system. So we had to go for a couple of cycles of testing, demoing. But what happened with that is that, although it took 3 to 4 months, we got the right tool in the end. And we signed actually a quite a long-term contract because we got the right tool. And we found what worked for us in the context of the people and what we were trying to achieve. So the importance of that was we could have actually gone for any of those tools quite quickly and signed a deal, and then to figure out, actually, we now need to get out of that deal, or God forbid, have signed that deal for a year, then buy another tool to fix what that other tool couldn't do, and then have two contracts running at the same time. So it can sound like high effort, but what I'd invite you to think about is, what if you don't do it? If you don't do it, you could be in a nightmare situation, which I've inherited from taking over at companies before, where they've signed multiple contracts long-term with companies that you end up suffering with later on because it hits budgets, costs increase every year. So I think I'd always encourage people, as I say, to think about, you know, what if you don't do this stuff? If you just rush and make these decisions, it's not always going to work. And I mean, I would always say, and I'm going to say this because I was talking about the things that I've done, that the reason why I've always worked with a lot of the companies I have done for 3 to 5 years is because we've tested them so rigorously, and we've looked at what they could do. We've kind of kept up with them every year. I'm probably one of the worst persons to chase down product teams and get product updates, and I am one of those weirdos. So it's stuff like that where those have stayed with me for a long time because we made the effort up front to say what fits specifically for our organization. And the other caveat to that is going to be as well, especially if you're in a scale up, as you mature, tools are going to come and go. So there's going to be a tool that might fit for this year that's not going to fit for next year, because you might quickly go from 100 people. And then, you know, if you're getting that crazy Silicon Valley money, you might jump up and go to 600 people next year and you're in a different boat. So you definitely have to flex on what you're looking at. I think more in a scale up environment, because it's easy for me to say think infinite game, but it's not always easy to do that in a scale up when if you are rapidly growing. So definitely to consider what would happen if you don't do this, and also be looking at where you can definitely test the hell out of everything that you can with people. And then when you're signing contracts, as I say, more for scale ups and startups, you're probably looking at 12 months, right? That's kind of the maximum. I would not be advising anyone to sign 3-4 year crazy contracts with organizations, especially when you first started working with them, because again, a year is good for you and the vendor, because you could be the vendor's worst nightmare for you, and they might want to get out from you. So we have to kind of figure out, you know, does it work both ways for people, and does it continue to serve your organization depending upon how you're growing as an organization too. So those would be, I suppose, very loose principles that I would, you know, encourage you to kind of take away and experiment with them in your own domain.
Yeah, so much. Yes, I agree with that so much. I think having seen it firsthand, like at how now customers that go on to be really successful are the ones that come with clarity around the features and problems. They are the ones that test it with the end user. They are the ones that soft launch it and really understand if it solves the problem in practice before they commit. So I really agree there. I'll actually drop another link in the chat. Alfie and our team here put together a free RFP template that people can use to kind of build up that consistent thing of list of non-negotiables. Here are the things you should go to look for. I think that non-negotiable one really spoke to me, because if you don't know that, then you can get overwhelmed by features, because once you jump on a call with someone, of course they want to tell you about every single exciting feature that the platform has. But if you're just clear on, look, these are the 3 or 4 things I need to solve, or I'm really looking to learn about your product, you get so much better at building that shortlist and whittling people down. And then you reduce the chances of ending up at that point you mentioned where you've invested so much time testing something that you've sunk all this cost into it, and you feel reticent to back out of the process. But if you think that it's painful to go through that process again, to your point, like imagine how bad it's going to be to unpick a tool that doesn't help you from the company, or to get out of the contract for something that doesn't solve your problem or suit your end user. So I completely agree. And I really think that's great practical advice for people.
Cool. Yeah, I would definitely say from experience, procurement conversations are not good conversations. When they start coming on about how do we exit said contract, they are incredibly painful.
Yeah. The other point as well, what got you here won't get you there, is a great mindset as well, because I think I'm speaking from personal experience, I'm not sure we're always scrutinizing the existing tools with the same level we would for a new tool we're bringing in, but it's worth doing that audit every now and then to just say, to your 3 questions earlier, like, what problem are we solving? Who is it serving? And is it the best product to do that? You have to kind of keep asking that over time of your tech and making sure it is still the right fit.
Yeah, it's like with anything, isn't it? I mean, there's so many examples where you can look at it with phones. You can look at, you know, a prime example is I used to use Windows laptops for years, and now I'm a hardcore Mac user over the last 3 years. But that's because my life changed, my work changed. So in terms of my use case for what I actually need to do, I need the technology that fits for that. So you can apply this in many realms of tech use. And I think its real charm, I suppose, is in its simplicity. It's not about sitting there and going through. I see some of the stuff online, like complicated frameworks and 500 questions. Honestly, you don't need to be doing that. It's just focusing on the basics of usability at the end of the day. You're going to use the product most often that helps you, and the products that are going to win are the products that are helping their end users to do whatever the things that they want to do. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, I've definitely fallen into the trap of unnecessarily overcomplicating it before. And I think hopefully this framework is a way for people to really streamline that. We're going to take a few questions in a moment. So I see we've already got one, but drop any more in the chat. But was there anything as well we didn't cover on the piloting that you wanted to mention? Anything around that, like the audience you test it with, decision making at the end? Because I know we kind of combined two of the things we were going to talk about then.
Yeah, I'm not really. I think, look, I'd always say this is kind of my truth, not the truth. So I am, you know, been exploring and been in the LND world for a while, but, you know, take what I say as contextual to the experiences that I've got. So they are principles, and, you know, see if they can work where you are, because you'll all be in different situations, potentially, to where I was. Potentially you might be in the same situation I was over the kind of last 15 years. So it's definitely not taking it as you must tick all these boxes, otherwise it doesn't work. Not the case at all. It's like, here's a framework that you can use, and you can definitely adapt if you need to, and go from there. But I think the main point is that as much as possible, make sure you're not doing this stuff in silo. So when we talk about the ideal customer, when we talk about bringing in people to demo, it's just you making sure that you are validating what you think you already know with actual data, and then making sure that the people, as we discuss, who you are serving are actually going to get benefit. Because it's no worse feeling than spending months, or in some cases, people will spend years trying to acquire products thinking, you know, this is going to, the most overused word I hear all the time, be the game changer for our organization, and actually doesn't end up that way. It ends up being a 6-week wonder. And unfortunately, a lot of that happens, as we said, because the kind of correct due diligence wasn't done at the beginning. So I think it's really just, as much as it's all hard for us because we're all the center of our own universes, and I'm the worst because my ego is terrible, but we have to kind of think outside of that kind of like area of where we are. I think that's also a good point in terms of, I talk about it as often, if any of you see me on LinkedIn, is about, you know, if you want to be a valued L&D partner, if you want to be, everyone talks about performance consulting and strategic partner, it is about bringing people into that mix with you. It's reaching out to the organization and saying, you know, we want to collaborate with you on making the best technology decisions for the performance of our organization. So again, this is just a kind of, you know, another string in the bow of building those relationships, doing that, getting insight, and really helping you make those decisions there. So I think, yeah, the main bit is get that customer, make sure you've got that open relationship with your stakeholders. And I think you, hopefully you won't go wrong with that.
Awesome advice. Yeah, stuff built on assumptions, probably going to fail. Stuff built in silos, probably going to fail. So I really, really thank you for going through that template in such detail, because I know it's going to help a lot of people.
Mm.
The question that we got in the chat was around any recommendations, particularly in, for tools that you like or anything. I know you mentioned actually that learning tech is wider than what we perceive it is. Actually, it's just tech that solves problems for learning. So widen it out. Is there any tools you'd recommend for people to check out, personal favorites that you'd highlight?
Yeah, I'm going to be that guy that answers the question with question, I suppose. It depends. It really depends. And again, going back to what we've already discussed, you know, what are you trying to solve? Like, what is the context? So I could tell you a million tools. They might, you know, not mean anything for you. So yeah, I would say with that, again, going back to what is it you're trying to solve? In terms of me nowadays, you know, again, if people follow me, I suppose, because I own my own business now and I do my own stuff, really. You know, a lot of the tools that I use personally are more around, of course, generative AI, because everyone's doing that right now, automation tools, but, you know, really tools that help build my business. So very common things that you're all probably using, like Notion, Slack, any of that kind of stuff. But that's probably not the answer you want, but it's not really an answer that I can give any of you, unless I know more.
Yeah, no, it's fitting of the first point we mentioned on the template to kind of really know the context. Mm. There was also a little bit of a question around maybe referrals and recommendations. One of the things I always find best is to see if someone has time to just show me it, like the way they use it, or maybe if they can't, you know, their stuff, they might not be able to show you because it's sensitive. But I remember trying to use this platform called Shield, which is about a really professional approach to LinkedIn and social media analytics. And I knew that a guy used it on quite a big level of scale. So I just reached out to him. Do you have 30 minutes to kind of go through this thing with me? I've reached out to other people. Can you send me a Loom video of actually like 4 or 5 of the ways you use this in practice? I think that's a really useful thing, because you can get a bit more of a contextual application or understand actually when someone gets into this tool, how are they using it? What's the navigation like of the tool? So that would be one tip I would give people. But anything when it comes to like that reaching out for referrals that works particularly well for you?
Yeah, I think very similar, to be fair. And as I mentioned, like all of the learning tech decisions I had made, it's a long time to go through my mind for at the moment, but I think all of them were actually made on recommendations from fellow practitioners. I haven't bought anything based on, I'm sorry to any salespeople, any sales emails or cold pitches that I get. And that's because, you know, pretty much that you said as well, that they're either people I know or know of, and I see them talking about stuff and like, oh, this thing's really helped me do that. So yeah, I did the same thing. I reach out to people, you know, pre-pandemic when we used to see more of each other in real life, I'd actually go to an office and sit with a team for an hour and see the tool and have the conversation. And I think, look, most of the time you'll see people who want to do that. They're quite open to do that. And just show you how that works. Another point into that is that I think really good suppliers will put you in touch with current customers. And that's what I've always done with any supplier, is they'll basically say, look, we've got these companies right now that are in similar sectors to you, even ask people in other sectors as well, because it's just great for our interest. But good suppliers will definitely set you up on maybe 2 to 3 calls with current customers who are using the tool, and just do that. I mean, that's not something covered actually, but you should definitely add that in, especially if you haven't had it from a referral or recommendation from someone else and you haven't seen the tool. So to just get that hands-on from another L&D pro where no one from the supplier is in the conversation is just really nice, because then, you know, they haven't really got any skin in the game. We could say this, you know, they don't care if the supplier makes money or not. They're just another L&D pro who's like, hey, you know, this is how I'm using it. And if they're able to say, yeah, it's helped me do 1, 2, and 3, and they've used the tool for like a year, then that's pretty, pretty good to understand, and a pretty good, you know, recommendation in itself.
Yeah, no, 100%. That's something we do as well. It's just there probably is going to be someone else using the platform or the tool or the product who has the same problem or is in a similar space to you, or best case, both of those things. So ask if you can speak to those people. And like you said, they'll give you a more objective, more practical kind of insight into how it can be used. So definitely great advice. Perfect. 100%. Ross, we've answered all the questions, so we've come to the end of today's show. I just want to say a massive thank you again for coming on, and thank you everyone for joining us and sharing your thoughts with us in the chat. So that brings us to the end of this brilliant conversation with Ross. I really feel like there was some great practical advice in there that you can then use alongside that template to make sure you're finding the right tech for your problems to solve. Whether that is tech you've already got or new tech you need to go out, test and pilot using Ross's recommendations. So just a final reminder that the template Ross mentioned and the template I mentioned from our team here at HowNow will both be in this episode description, so you can download them both for free today. Thanks again, and see you next time.